The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, March 14th. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffering. In tonight's news, more on that West Side planning meeting where residents raised havoc.
An incumbent in the Dane County Board race shares his campaign priorities.
And in the second half, a conversation about transparency in government, the most up-to-date fishing report, and the latest from Madison's Flamingos.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Leffering with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines.
Protesters in Milwaukee greeted President Biden yesterday with a pledge to withhold their votes in the upcoming presidential primary. That is, if he doesn't push more effectively for a ceasefire in Gaza. About 125 people gathered downtown in Red Arrow Park, near the location of the Biden campaign's new Wisconsin headquarters, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Janine Najib, president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, estimated that 40,000 Muslim voters live in Wisconsin. Biden won Wisconsin in 2020 by 20,000 votes.
A lopsided vote in Congress to force a Chinese company to divest of the social media app TikTok has two dissenters from Wisconsin, Democrats Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore. The bill, which passed Wednesday 352-65, was introduced by another Wisconsin representative, Green Bay Republican Mike Gallagher. All six Wisconsin Republicans voted in favor of the measure. Gallagher contends that the Chinese stake in the company poses a security risk to the country and an access point to exploit users' personal data, according to the Badger Project. Pocan and Moore argued that the action against TikTok alone leaves personal data vulnerable on other social media platforms like Facebook and X.
A state Supreme Court ruling today denying a tax exemption for an operation run by the Catholic Church could have nationwide impact if the case advances to the federal level, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. In a 4-3 decision, the court rejected an unemployment tax exemption for the Superior-based Catholic Charities Bureau. The Bureau's operations are secular, the court found, even if its goals are based on Catholic teachings. Attorneys for the Bureau said they would appeal the ruling directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. The case is a rare challenge to the tax exemptions that religious organizations enjoy across the country on the basis of the constitutional separation of church and state.
A measure to broaden funding eligibility for municipal wastewater and stormwater improvement projects was signed into law today by Governor Tony Evers. Evers also approved a bill to allow the use of air guns to hunt big game in the state, one of 15 pieces of legislation the governor signed. Work on sewer lines and laterals will now be eligible for aid from the state's Clean Water Fund, which is supported by state tax revenue and federal funding from the 2021 Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Air gun use was previously limited to hunting for small game, such as rabbits. The change in the law permits them to be used to hunt animals such as deer and black bear.
Those were the headlines. And now, on to the rest of today's top stories.
West area residents disrupted a city planning presentation at Memorial High on Tuesday, voicing concerns about the ways Madison's West Side could change. But while residents interrupted city planners inside the classroom, genuine dialogue happened in the hallways outside. WORT News Director Shali Pittman was there and has the story with news producer Faye Parks.
The line outside the classroom at Vell Phillips Memorial High School grew steadily over about 45 minutes, stretching eventually down the entirety of the hallway. Some couldn't even get in the door for the planned presentation and small group discussion, which didn't end up happening. Residents were there to attend the latest in a series of presentations on the draft West Area Plan, but instead attendees interrupted city planners and shouted out their disapproval.
Yep. That's true. But this is the present. We're going to give a quick presentation now. We've heard feedback in the past that people wanted presentations, so we're going to do that so that folks
show
can see.
Show of hands, how many
address.
Want to see the presentation?
Okay, so tonight we're going to be covering what area plans are, what the West area is all about, our planning process
in the Southgate Corridor.
We have, like I said, we haven't done the design yet, so I don't have an estimated cost. If you look at all the maps,
why even do a path when that whole block is surrounded by bike lanes?
We have.
City planner Linda Horvath tells WORT that attendance on Tuesday was unexpectedly high.
Probably the most people we've had at an in-person meeting was maybe 30 or 40, I would say. So based on past experience, you know, we just haven't had that many people coming in person. We've had virtual meetings. We've, you know, leading up to this because we wanted to give people that option as well. And so we had maybe, I'd say, about 125 people total. Virtual means.
Westside Alder Bill Tischler represents one of several districts covered by the proposed West Area Plan. He says Tuesday's meeting was the most contentious public meeting he's ever been to, and he was somewhat anticipating this response.
People are clearly angry, and I think they just want to be heard. And although Zoom does allow people to to kind of all come together and hear a presentation, I think there's something very powerful about people coming together in a room and letting their voice be heard just by being together, and as we saw here, just raising their hands when they're not in favor of something or clapping when they do support something. So this is kind of how democracy is supposed to look, in my opinion.
At issue is the draft West Area Plan. It's one of the city's first under a new framework for urban planning that carves the city into 12 slices. The new framework was approved in 2022, and the draft for this side of the city started in January of 2023. The draft plan covers a wide section of the west side, covering more than 8.5 miles. That's larger than the old standard of neighborhood plans. Already those plans are being archived, meaning they're no longer being used to guide development, city projects, policies, or budgets. If approved, the draft West Area Plan would help guide land use for the future. That's as the city's steadily grown each decade and is preparing for even more growth to come. Horvath says they're now expecting 110,000 more Madison residents by 2050. The draft plan is in the final stage of public feedback before being introduced to the Common Council, and residents on Tuesday voiced concerns that the plan would materially change the character of their West Side neighborhoods. Scott Sussman says he opposes the plan and doesn't think it's well thought out. When asked by WORT why he chose to attend, Sussman says his top issue was
the pool, the neighborhood pool, that's definitely an issue, and also the churches, how they're impacting churches, definitely.
He's referencing an issue brought to light last week in a controversial opinion piece in the Capital Times, written by the newspaper's publisher, Paul Fanland. That piece pointed to what could happen to the Hill Farm Swim Club, a 60-year-old private swim club at the heart of the West Side, if it were ever sold. The swim club, alongside other areas like church parking lots, could be subject to what the city planners refer to in the West Area Plan as proactive zoning. That process would rezone future property consistent with its recommended land use described in the plan. That process, though, would require additional action from the council to take effect. City planners are careful to make the distinction that the proposed plan would not rezone the West Side. It would indicate, though, where rezoning would be likely to happen in the coming years. But many of the attendees on Tuesday took those reassurances with a grain of salt. Some argued that the draft plan is just an invitation for wealthy developers to swoop in and change their neighborhoods with little oversight. Gail Bliss is a resident of the Hill Farms neighborhood and was also at Tuesday's meeting. She's been attending these types of meetings for over the last year.
About 90% of the plan looks perfectly reasonable to me. And a lot of people are very frustrated that they don't feel they're being heard. And I am somewhat frustrated that some of the material was pretty unclear.
Overall, Bliss says she's been okay with other recent changes that the city's made in guiding the future of living and moving through Madison.
I'm within the transit overlay. Fine with me. I remember going around telling my neighbors, this does not mean everybody is going to tear down their house tomorrow. Similarly, the redesignation of churches as possible places for more housing strikes me as very practical.
In recent years, the city's made other decisions that have rankled some West Siders. Things like changing the definition of single-family housing, creating transit overlay districts, and implementing bus rapid transit. But residents have a bit of a cudgel to push back on the city this time around. The city of Madison is facing a yawning gap in its budget for next year, and it could need to ask voters this November to approve a referendum that raises taxes. Jenny Iskandar is a longtime resident of Sauk Creek and lives right next to the Sauk Creek Greenway. She says that 12 years ago, when the city wanted to make necessary sewer improvements, she was able to work with city planners to seek compromise over details of their plan. Recently, she's been helping to lead the neighborhood's push against another proposed city improvement, this time a potential bike and pedestrian path running through the Greenway. She's been regularly attending transportation and planning meetings and even brought her bright yellow binder to Tuesday's meeting. I asked Iskandar if her interactions with the city over the bike path would inform her vote in November if a referendum is on the ballot.
Most definitely. I mean, if they come to us asking us for more money or, you know, tax increases to cover their shortfalls, I would definitely think twice about that with the interaction that we've had with the city on this.
Jane Meyer lives in the Tamarack community. While waiting in line to get in, she says many West Side residents feel that there's been too many surprises in this planning process. She agrees that this planning process could inform her vote on a potential referendum.
If the city were to actually look at their spending and eliminate the unnecessary spending that's occurring in this plan, over $2 million just for this bike path, things that they don't need that nobody's asking for, because at this moment I would absolutely not support a referendum. I would not support it at all, and especially since schools are going to be needing some.
Tuesday's meeting wasn't officially recorded by the city, but Alder Bill Tischler recorded a video of the proceedings inside the classroom. In less than 48 hours on YouTube, it's racked up almost 4,500 views. Some online panned the crowd's reaction, pointing out the West Siders likely left outside of the conversation. Harry Jin is a high school junior and will graduate in 2025. He lives just outside what would be covered by the West Area Plan, but bikes through it every day. Tuesday wasn't his first planning meeting. He says he finds it interesting, and he likes that the city is looking to the future.
Personally, I think it's like great that we're looking to like take action and be ambitious with like how we see the future of the city. Like, we're looking right now to really see the change that could be happening that we could use to address problems like climate, like housing and transportation safety, right?
Harry says for people his age, it's important to be ambitious now.
The city is caring about things like housing that are becoming a pretty massive struggle. Like, it completely determines where younger people live, right? Like, some of my teachers at high school who are younger have to commute from all over and like 30 minutes away because they can't find housing that works for them near the school. So
he has a license, but driving stresses him out. Jin says he prefers to bike and take the bus most places and is excited about bus rapid transit. He says that in these planning conversations, the voices of young people and students especially aren't really being heard. For Linda Horvath, one of the city's urban planners, it's not the first time she's had a contentious meeting in Madison or working elsewhere.
When people are motivated and, you know, passionate, it's actually pretty awesome for us because we want people to be involved. We want to hear what they have to say. And sometimes we can't always satisfy. We're not going to always be able to do what somebody wants us to do, but yeah.
The deadline to submit written feedback on the West Area Plan is next Wednesday, March 20th. After this meeting, though, that deadline is likely to be extended. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Shali Pittman. Faye Parks contributed additional research and production.
In less than 3 weeks, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. Two candidates are vying for the District 20 seat, incumbent supervisor Jeff Wiegand and challenger Andrea Andrews. District 20 represents the northeast corner of the county, containing the villages of Marshall and Morrisonville. Earlier today, Wygand spoke to WORT news producer Faye Parks to discuss his priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what are some of your accomplishments since being elected to the county board?
I'm married to my wife, Melissa, and we have five young children. We live in Marshall. And I was elected to the county board in a special election in August of 2021. And in April of 2022, I was reelected for a full term, and I've been serving on the county board ever since. I'm a member of the Public Protection and Judiciary Committee, where we work heavily on issues related to law enforcement and public safety. And I'm really proud of the record that I have being on the county board. I've introduced measures to increase public safety, to streamline government services, and ensure that the county focuses on the issues that are most important to our citizens. And right now, I believe that, you know, the county board is too often times an echo chamber for the interests of Madison. And I'm really proud of my record of standing up for the rural parts of Dane County and the folks in the 20th district that live outside of Madison and really have different opinions, different worldviews, and different ideas on how county government should operate.
So going off of that, what are some of your priorities for District 20 specifically?
Specifically, I want to continue to fight back against human trafficking and stolen vehicles. In particular, we've seen the spike in stolen vehicles impacting District 20 residents disproportionately compared to other areas of the county. Specifically, they've hit up my neighborhood numerous times in Marshall, where they've also hit up Windsor numerous times as well. Thankfully, the Dane County Sheriff's Office has been proactive in mitigating this. And it's just something that I want to continue to support them on, make sure that they have the tools and resources needed to continue to focus their efforts against that. Being a victim of a stolen vehicle or someone breaking into your home is very traumatizing. And I take that very seriously, and I want to make sure that those type of incidents stop. Another issue that is very near and dear to me is human trafficking. And unfortunately, in my district, there is one of two strip clubs in Dane County, and it's widely known that that strip club can be a breeding ground for human trafficking. And so making sure that the Dane County Sheriff's Office has the resources that they need to do their job effectively, I'm very proud to have introduced a budget amendment that would actually add an extra detective and two crime analysts in the Dane County Sheriff's Office to fight human trafficking, be, you know, specifically dedicated to that issue. So it's an issue that's very near and dear to my heart. It's an issue that's very near and dear to the citizens in the 20th District, and I'm very proud to have worked on that, and we'll look forward to continuing to work on that.
When it comes to the county as a whole, what are your priorities there?
The biggest thing that I would like the county as a whole to get back to is just the basics. We have core services that are being neglected. You know, I think our county highways need to be invested in more heavily. I think public safety in general and as a whole need to be reprioritized. And I think we as a county board need to get back to those examples of the basics. You know, a lot of times the county board likes to pontificate on issues that are of national importance or, you know, state importance. But really, we're, you know, neglecting the core responsibilities that we have right here in Dane County. And two of them being public safety and transportation infrastructure. I think those are two things that as a county board, we should really reprioritize, put them at the top of our priority and make sure that we're investing in them, making sure that we're giving them the proper attention that they need. Because the two biggest things that I hear from my constituents are, hey, you know, this county road is in bad repair, or, hey, you know, I'm really upset that the number of police sirens I'm hearing, or, you know, the amount of times that I see incidents on the news of crime or things like that happening. So just making sure that we're listening to our constituents and getting back to those core basics.
So you mentioned some of your work on PP&J. Is there any other work or anything else you'd like to continue if reelected in April?
Well, I think streamlining government services, I think I was successful in passing a resolution that would streamline the way that we process insurance claims. You know, I dramatically reduced the amount of steps and the bureaucracy around that process. I think there's a lot of opportunities around that. I'm also proud of the work that I did on expanding ATV and UTV recreation countywide. ATV, UTV recreation is a really fast-growing outdoor recreation that a lot of people are enjoying these days, and I think that we can look at ways of expanding that even further, really just trying to get people outdoors and enjoy the beautiful aspects of Dane County. I have the opportunity to represent a very rural part of the county, and there's a lot of great natural resources that people can enjoy.
So I know that affordable housing is a big talking point this year and in past years as well. What is your perspective on that?
That's another one that a lot of folks certainly mention, is the price of a home in Dane County has skyrocketed, and we've all seen the impacts of that. There's a lot of different ways that we can approach that topic. Historically, the county board has almost exclusively chosen to take the approach of government funding to affordable housing, but I don't think that's the only approach that we should take. I think we should look at other examples. Most notably, we can look at examples from Minneapolis that did some kind of creative things with zoning to encourage different types of building to occur. And I'm not saying we should do exactly what Minnesota did, but I think there's other examples around the country that we can look at, like Minneapolis, and just get creative with what we can do to incentivize and encourage development of homes that are affordable. I do not think that government funding of housing is the only solution. Unfortunately, that's really the only solution that we as a county board have explored. But another one is just looking at regulations where we can encourage people to get into homes that maybe are, you know, could use some work. And let's try to encourage that instead of disincentivize that by creating regulations and fees that really make it unaffordable. And we need to look at our taxes. The county board passed a double-digit property tax increase in this most recent budget. I was the only supervisor to vote no, because I think that double-digit property tax increase is absolutely appalling and not sustainable.
So, meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race?
I encourage all of the candidates that are running for county executive to spend just as much, if not more, time outside of Madison as they do inside of Madison. Over 50% of Dane County's population lives outside of the city of Madison, and I hope that the next county executive will truly be an executive for all of Dane County and not try to be the executive for Madison. Madison already has a mayor. We don't need another person trying to run the city of Madison. We need an executive who is going to truly give due attention to the majority of people in Dane County that live outside of Madison.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think it's important that the voters of the 20th District understand that they have a choice. They have a choice between someone like myself that's going to stand up for the rural parts of the county, that's going to stand up for the citizens of the 20th District, or they can go with a candidate that is supported by Madison. And I think that distinction is very clear. You know, if they want another rubber stamp for the Madison agenda, that's fine. Then they can vote that way. But if they want someone that's going to stand up for public safety, if they want someone that's going to stand up for the beliefs and values of the 20th District, then that's their choice.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Faye.
That was incumbent supervisor Jeff Wigand, one of two candidates vying for the District 20 seat on the Dane County Board. District 20 represents the county's northeast corner, containing the villages of Marshall and Morrisonville. Wigand says if he retains his seat, he will continue to bring a more rural perspective to the board and advocate for more investment in public safety. We heard from his challenger, Andrea Andrews, earlier this week. You can access her interview on our website. Wigand and Andrews will face off on April 2nd.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
It's Sunshine Week in Wisconsin. Tonight in Madison, the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council is presenting the Openness in Government Awards, otherwise known as the OPIES. In this episode of Transparency Talk, WORT's Dylan Brogan and attorney Tom Kamenick from the Wisconsin Transparency Project have this year's award winners.
Joining me now is Tom Kamenick. Tom, how you doing?
Dylan, I'm doing great. Happy Sunshine Week here.
Yes, and it's also awards seasons. A lot of big-time awards. And, of course, the...
Are we going to talk about the Oscars today, Dylan?
No, we're going to talk about the Opies, even better than the Oscars. Somehow Oppenheimer won all the Opies, too.
The Oppenheimer Opies.
Yes. No, just kidding about that. The Freedom of Information Council puts out awards every year about transparency in government, and sometimes not transparency in government. And the first award, it goes to Kurt Green, and it's a POPI, the Public Openness Award. So tell us why, first of all, who's Kurt Green, and why does he get a POPI this year?
Kurt Green is the coroner for Manitowoc County over in Lake Michigan, east side of the state, and the POPI goes to a public servant who has furthered the cause of openness. And some years that can be a little bit hard to find, but this time Mr. Green did a great job. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was writing doing research and writing articles on gun deaths specifically, and was trying to get information about manners of gun deaths and the details of gun deaths from all the counties around the state, which incidentally they had to do because the state Department of Administration Vital Records Office would not turn any of these things over, so they had to go county by county. Most counties did an average job. Some counties were pretty terrible. We'll talk about one of those later. But Kirk Green in Manitowoc went above and beyond, providing by far the most detailed gun death data out of any county in the state. And he had actually reached out to the reporters, too, and said that he appreciated they were doing this and that he thought he could use the opportunity to look for trends and...
Yeah.
Information, what's leading to gun deaths. It's very different statewide too, in rural areas versus urban areas.
Absolutely. Well, and interesting that one coroner, right, wins the POPI, for being a supporter of open government, and the NOPI this year, which goes to No Friend of Openness, goes to another coroner from a different county that was working on that same project that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was doing on gun deaths. So let's skip right to that one, the NOPI.
That one is going to Bonnie Kinchy, the coroner for Trempealeau County. Out of the state's 72 counties, she absolutely refused to turn over any of this information. Now, there were some counties that provided scant amounts of information and didn't provide a lot of detail to it, but she just flat out said, I don't want to do this. I'm not turning this information over. I don't think you should have it. Eventually, we got there was a new county corporation counsel, the county's attorney, in Trempealeau County. We talked to them. Finally, the county came around and started providing the data much later than everybody else.
Yes. Well, interesting, the polar opposites, right, for public officials involved in kind of the same story. So that's a fun thing that the Freedom of Information Council did this year. The next one is the MOPI, and that's the Media Openness Award, and that goes to an investigator with Wisconsin Watch.
And this is Jacob Resnick, and Jacob has been doing a series of stories on police agencies, law enforcement agencies that are withholding all kinds of new information because of Marcy's Law. That was the constitutional amendment a few years back that added additional victim rights into our state constitution. And not all, but several sheriffs and police departments around the state have taken to redacting or withholding large amounts of information now about crimes, citing to Marcy's Law. So Jacob was reporting about that and specifically got into, one of the examples of a story was a police cadet. She was fired after reporting a fellow cadet had sexually assaulted her. And then we have a whole bunch of claims from their police department. Well, this is everybody's a victim in this, and we can't release information about this. And it just makes it hard to hold police officers accountable when the agencies are claiming that they're victims at the same time.
Yes, and as we've talked about before, a lot of unintended consequences with Marcy's Law and that state constitutional amendment. So, all right, the COPI, that's the Citizen Openness Award, that goes to a Milwaukee-based interfaith advocacy group called Common Ground. So tell us why Common Ground is being awarded the COPI this year.
Common Ground used the power of record requests to dig into terrible conditions in affordable housing apartments that are managed by the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee. So they've been sounding alarms about dangerous conditions, bringing attention to this, and I think there's been some movement to improve things with the Milwaukee Housing Authority. So they did some great work.
Some excellent work, and it's always great to see when open records and good investigative reporting leads to action. And that's kind of what happened with this year's Scoopy, the Open Records Scoop of the Year. And that goes to Wisconsin State Journal reporter Lucas Robinson. So how did he use open records to get the Scoop of the Year?
Lucas was digging into incidents and even deaths at Green Bay Correctional Facility, making requests to the local sheriff's department and to the prison itself, finding out that guards had had criminal charges for smuggling items into the prison to give to inmates, other issues with serious neglect of inmate, including one that led to a death after an inmate in a wheelchair needed to go to the infirmary and he was denied, and then the guards failed to follow up and check on them. No guards were charged with any crimes or wrongdoing with that. And so very good for Lucas for bringing attention to that. And we've been seeing some reform from lawmakers based on it, too. So.
Yeah, great to see that. All right, we're on to the whoopee. I think I got that one right. The whistleblower of the year. It's an alder person, right, that gets the whistleblower of the year. Tell us about this individual.
That is Mark Gierl, a Wisconsin Transparency Project client and former alderman of the city of Mequon in Ozaukee County. He filed not one but two lawsuits against the Mequon-Thiensville School District when they kept withholding the email addresses, lists of email addresses they used to send mass messages out to the public, and they refused to turn them over. We sued twice. We won both cases. We won both cases on appeal, and those both finished up over the past year or so. And so the award goes to Mr. Gierl for taking that fight to I was going to say City Hall. That's not quite right. Taking the fight to the school district, to the school board.
Hey, you were involved in kind of in one way or another a few of these award winners. So congratulations to you too. You've won one of these before in OP, right?
That's right. When I formed the Transparency Project in 2020, I was awarded the Citizens Openness Award for taking that step. Every year since then, Wisconsin Transparency Project clients have been among the winners. And thankfully, never among the losers of the NOPE.
Thankfully. And we know you take it seriously. You got all dressed up in your tuxedo and everything for presenting these awards today. So we appreciate you doing that, Tom.
My pleasure, Dylan. And remember, everybody, if you don't ask, you won't know.
It's a rainy Thursday here in Madison, and while that might make getting out to fish a little less comfortable, at least the fish are happy after the dry winter. But this weekend is looking nice, and on this week's Fishy Business, Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg break down where the fish are biting.
Alrighty, I'm on the line with Pat Hansberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, it is a rainy Thursday here in Madison, but I mean, it's good to have a little bit of rain after we had such a dry winter. I mean, the rivers and everything will really appreciate that in a couple of months here, the rain that we're getting now. So just sort of looking at what's going on around Madison. Pat, how are things looking around town?
Well, they're looking up. You're right with this rain. It maybe isn't the best for getting folks out fishing on a cold day, but we certainly needed the water, and lake levels around the Madison area have been very low, so those should come up pretty quick here, and that'll get the fish in a better mood. That being said, folks have been doing well on panfish in a lot of shallow areas around town, and heading to the rivers too, and finding some good walleye action out there too. So a lot of good and trout fishing, a lot of good opportunities to get out fishing this time of year.
And well, let's just start by going down the list, starting off with Lake Mendota. What's happening around there?
Lake Mendota has been a lot of good action up in the Cherokee Park area, Cherokee Marsh. You know, those shallow areas are the first to warm up. So up in the Cherokee Park area itself, they've been getting some bass up there and some good panfish action down to the 113 bridge. Some crappies have been showing up through there and some small perch. Other areas around Mendota have also been good. Just look for shallow waters, so Marshall Park, Spring Harbor, University Bay, stuff like that. Anywhere there's shallow water is where you're going to likely find fish as those areas warm up first.
As a shore fisherman, that's good for me to hear. I appreciate when the fish hang out in the shallower water there. And let's move over to Lake Monona. What's happening over there?
Sort of the same deal down there. Find shallow water and you'll likely find fish. Good areas to check out this time of year are where the Yahara River dumps in, kind of on the northwest end of the lake. The Monona Bay has been producing some good crappie action lately and some bluegills mixed in there. Other areas like Weechowuk Bay and Turville Bay have been good, and the lagoon up at Winnequah Park in Monona is always a great early season spot. So lots of good opportunities out there for folks.
And now let's move over to Lake Wingra. Now, I know it's not quite spring yet, technically, but it's starting to feel like spring. And spring is when I like to hit Wingra because it tends to get pretty weedy once the summer comes. So what's happening over on Wingra?
Well, you're right. It's a great lake full of fish, a lot of smaller panfish, but some large, big largemouth bass in there. So a lot of good opportunities, and yeah, enjoy it before the weeds get too thick in there. The area below the Wingrat Dam is closed right now as a fish refuge, but I did hear that there have been some nice muskies sighted in there, and so they'll swim up to that dam and they jump over the dam, and it's always kind of a bit of a spectacle to watch those impressive fish. So that's always a cool thing too. But yeah, a lot going on Wingrat this time of year.
And have the muskies started jumping up the dam there? I know that's, like you said, that's always a fun thing to watch every year. Has that started?
I heard a couple were trying to jump just yesterday. So the water's been low in there. So I bet with this rain we got, bring some levels up, and they'll start being pretty active down there for sure.
All right. Well, then let's move over to Lake Wabisa. What's happening over there?
Pretty much the same thing. If you can find shallow water, you're going to find fish. Upper Mud Lake between Monona and Wabisa is a great early spring spot. Not a lot of shore access there, so that'd be more for boat anglers. But on Wabisa, Lake Farm Park is always productive this time of year. Goodland Park on the south end of the lake is good, and the Babcock Park area is good. But again, the area below Babcock is also a fish refuge this time of year. So, find shallow water and you'll find fish.
And keep an eye on where you're fishing with the fish refuge this year. So, yeah, this time of year, something to keep an eye on. Well, let's move over to final lake that we're going to touch on, Lake Caganza. Have you been hearing anything coming out of there?
You know, not a lot. The only action I've heard about is on the north end of the lake where the Yahara River comes in there. That's a great shallow area, large, flat, shallow area where a lot of fish hang out this time of year. So some good panfish action up there to be had, but with game fish season closed right now, and it'll open back up on May 4th. Not a lot of folks out, you know, looking for walleye or pike or anything.
About one more month until things, about a month and a half, I guess, until things really start to open up with a game fish season opening and trout season opening. So looking forward to that in a little bit here, but still fishing to be had, including on all of the rivers. What's going on there? The Yahara, the Rock, the Wisconsin River, what's happening?
All the rivers have been producing a lot of good action for walleyes, especially at dams. So on the Wisconsin River, Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin Dells, Castle Rock, Pete Well dams have all been good. On the Rock River, the Jefferson Dam has been great. And from the Jefferson Dam down to Fort Atkinson, if you can find some deeper pockets, you will likely find some walleyes.
And last thing I want to touch on is the trout bite. Obviously, right now it is catch and release only, but what's happening with the trout bite around town?
The trout fishing has been good. The problem, like everywhere else, has been low water. So low, clear water and not a lot of grass to sneak around in on the banks makes the people fishing for trout easy to spot by the trout. So it can be a little bit of a challenge. But again, with this rain we've got, it should bring some of those water levels up and, you know, make the water maybe just a little bit cloudy so you can sneak up on it a little bit better. But this is a fantastic time of year to get out and chase trout. They live in beautiful places and they're real active, so it's a great time of year.
If you've never gone out and tried trout fishing before, this is probably a great time to get started. It's before the keeper season really begins, and yeah, it's not hot out. As long as you can put up with a little bit of the chilly weather, this is a great time to get out and get started. I would highly recommend it. Well, Pat, we are running up against the clock here for today. Do you have just any final fishing advice for all the people out there?
Just get out and enjoy the fabulous spring weather we've got. And, you know, this is a great time of year to be out fishing for a lot of different species. So get out and enjoy it while you can.
Well, that will have to do it for today. Pat, thank you so much for talking with me today. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime that you want just by calling 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thank you again, and good luck out there.
Thanks, Nate. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Forward Madison FC are set to kick off their 2024 USL League One campaign on Saturday, starting with an away game to Statesboro, Georgia. Ahead of that, Andrew and Grant sat down with veteran Flamingos winger and all-time scorer Derek Gebhard to discuss reuniting with teammates, the season ahead, and the importance of the U.S. Open Cup. For now, more now from Forward Focus.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT online and at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus. a segment devoted to any and all things Ford Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Ford Madison-themed magazine New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last left you, we brought you audio from Ford Madison's head coach and technical director, Matt Glazer. Glazer discussed the team's preseason slate, what he had been seeing so far, and what he and the coaching staff were looking for in the weeks ahead as Ford Madison gets set for the start of the 2024 campaign. For this week's segment, we sat down for a chat with speedy winger and veteran of the club, Derek Gebhard, to get his thoughts on the upcoming season and his preparation for his fourth season in the pink and blue. Andrew, take it away.
Derek Gebhard, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you guys for having me again. Happy to be back. Enjoying the weather today too.
How are you feeling ahead of this fourth season with the club?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling excited. Yeah, I think in all my years here so far, this is the first time it's been like a returning group that's more than like a few, like four or five guys or so. So yeah, just really looking forward to get the season started and see what we can do this year and try and be building off the last season we had.
Let's talk about the squad a little bit, because there are some new guys this season that add a little bit of a different quality maybe than we've seen from previous squads. Guys like Devin Boyce and Michael Chalaka, Sosa, all guys that play with a little bit of an edge. Do you feel a little bit of competition to sort of match where some of those guys are at as far as their mentality on match day?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely competition within the team. Like the quality that we have this year, I think being able to build off the players we had last year, then being able to add in some key guys is definitely created a lot of competition. There's a lot of quality. And you can see that when we're training. I wouldn't want to be the head coach and be having to make the decisions, but yeah, there's definitely been a good, and it's in a good way too, which I think is important. Just being competitive in training. Day in and day out, because then that can translate into the games for us as well if we're doing it every day in training.
Who's been the standout for you so far for the new guys?
Well, I could name a few really. Like I think Boyce is good for us. Sosa is good for us. The Omaha boys, you can see their quality and that they'll help us a lot. Galindrez is also a good attacking player. Well, Wolfie is here, but he was here last year. Augustine just came in. He's kind of getting adjusted and stuff, but you could see the quality he has as well. Oh, Jimmy as well. See, I'm forgetting everyone, but it reminds me a little bit of, Cello from last year. I feel like they're yeah. Similar in some ways, but yeah, he's been getting in as well too. I think he got like his dog and stuff here now, so I think he's feeling a little more at home right now and stuff, so I think that's good. But
I think a lot of fans are really excited for the squad this year. It seems like we've added a lot of quality. One of the main questions I think that's on a lot of fans' minds right now heading into this first game of the season is like, are any of the new guys really changing the dynamic of the team compared to previous teams that you've played in?
Yeah, I'd say so, because I think we just have more, I think I would say flexibility. Like we have guys that can play different positions. So I think like that'll add some flexibility into our team, where if we are to have any type of injury issues, there's guys that can fill in different spots, and there's guys that can switch roles and things like that for maybe if we're playing a different opponent and need a different type of player position. Like we have players that can do that. So I think that's what I'm noticing is like pretty different this year with this team, is like we have a lot of guys that are dynamic and can play multiple different roles for us.
Who would you say is the most improved returner that you've seen this year? Who have you seen, like, you know, from the guys that have returned that you've looked at and said, wow, like they were doing the work in the offseason, you could tell?
Yeah. Let me see. Returners. I think Jake is someone that just impressed me, because he like fit. Yeah, he came in like he was fit last year, but he came in this year like super fit. I think he had the highest like beep test score for us and everything. So like he impressed me with that, especially I think he was like here the whole off season. So that's when it really impressed me.
Yeah, I guess speaking to the Open Cup specifically, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, but what does it mean to you as somebody who came up playing in the US What does it mean to play in the U.S. Open Cup?
Yeah, it means a lot because I think it's an opportunity to like I was saying, like show that you can compete at other levels and it's also another trophy as well. So just another trophy to compete for and show that you can be competitive, not just in your league, but, you know, maybe against teams in higher leagues as well.
Sort of a follow-up maybe to that. Do you feel like it gets the respect it deserves, especially given the MLS clubs trying to pull out this season?
I would say no, because I think, like, I don't know the whole history of it, but I know it's been around for a long time, hasn't it? It's been around for
1914.
It's like a historical cup, so I feel like it's a good cup for everyone to play in for everyone, really. It's not a cup that's just there just for to get more viewers or money or something like that. I think it's just a genuine, like, it's a culture like cup that allows all teams to pretty much be able to participate and have a chance of winning a trophy.
Howard Madison FC is back in action this Saturday as they begin the 2024 USL1 campaign with a trip down to Statesboro, Georgia for a matchup against South Georgia Tormenta FC. Kickoff is at 6:30 p.m. local time and coverage is available on ESPN+. Following that, FMFC will host NPSL side Duluth FC in a matchup to open up tournament play in the historic U.S. Open Cup on Tuesday, March 19th. Kickoff is at 6 p.m. here in Madison at historic Bree Stevens Field. The Flamingos will then go back on the road for USL1 league play as they'll make the trip down to South Carolina to take on Greenville Triumph SC on Saturday, March 23rd. Kickoff will be at 6 p.m. local time and coverage again will be provided by ESPN+. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us again as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Forward Madison begins the 2024 season and their quest for USL1 glory. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And that's a wrap for WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Special thanks to feature contributors Dylan Brogan and Tom Kamenick, Nate Wiggyhout and Pat Hansberg, and the Ford Focus crew. Nicole Alley engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Ms. Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I am your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Hot Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.